One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
This is Lou Elizondo, and you are listening to That UFO Podcast.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to That UFO Podcast. My name is Andy. Just before I bring in my guest, I want to say thank you to everyone for listening in what is the week of the 2-year anniversary of the podcast. Confirmed already for May is Professor Gary Nolan. Some of you may know that. And just confirmed last week with me, Jeremy Corbell will be joining me on the 3rd of May for a conversation too. So a couple of really big guests in May following on from the guests I have with me today. So email any questions for those guests to UFOUAPAM@gmail.com. Both of those, as you can imagine, are going to be incredibly popular. To my guest for today's pod, making his third appearance for an interview, former head of the Pentagon's ATIP program, Mr. Luis Elizondo. Lou, welcome back to the podcast.
Always good to see you guys. Thank you so much. And thanks to your great audience, too, for having me and spending a little bit of time with us today.
It's always a very exciting conversation, and it's one of those, hopefully we can do it justice for the many people who have sent in questions, and I'm only sorry I couldn't have you for 5 or 6 hours to get through even half of them that have been sent over. Lou, it's been 4.5 years since you resigned from your role at ATIP and came forward alongside a team of others at To the Stars Academy of Arts and Science, as it was known. A lot has happened since then, and as we sit here now, how do you reflect upon that time?
Oh, wow. Andy, it's been bittersweet. I never wanted to be in a situation where I had to resign my position in the first place. But unfortunately that was the hand I was dealt. And as I've said before, you know, a lot of us in national security take our jobs very seriously. In fact, we go to war for it and are willing to put our lives on the line for it. So, for me, it was a very difficult, decision and a difficult journey, but a decision that really was already made for me, because a lot of people that are in my situation, it's not just me, we take an oath, and that oath is to the American people and to our Constitution and our government and whatnot. And what it's not, though, is an oath to bureaucracy. And there comes a point if the bureaucracy becomes overwhelming and becomes a hindrance, an interference, then one has to make a decision. And there's this unwritten code of ethic that we have within national security. If you can't fix the problem, you don't make it worse by staying. You leave try to fix it maybe from the outside, but you don't want to be disruptive while on the inside. That's not the proper way to do it. So I did what many before me and after me have done. I've resigned. I resigned my position as a matter of protest, because I could not get the attention that was necessary on this topic at the time through my chain of command. Now I think people are seeing the rest of the story. There were deliberate roadblocks. I actually could not brief certain elements within my chain of command simply because of issues involving them, character issues and other issues. And so what I wound up doing is taking it to the streets, right? And I didn't think that when I left, it would have been received, especially by the one community that was dying for information and transparency. I was really surprised to see a lot of the pushback, if you will, and the disbelief initially. I'm not a ufologist. I'm not into ufology. I'm just a government servant. And, you know, what we did was look at UFOs. And that's just the bottom line. And when I came out and we had that conversation, I was surprised at the amount of distrust people had in that fact. And I think a lot of it is because in the past, the government probably wasn't transparent. Keep in mind, I was relatively new to this. I came into ATIP in 2008. So a lot of the history I wasn't aware of, and nor did I really concern myself with. So for me, it was whether I'm chasing terrorists or chasing spies or chasing UFOs. It's pretty much the same kind of job, really. It was only later that I realized that there was so much distrust by the American people and by, frankly, citizens of the world on this topic, because governments, and I say the governments, plural, have lied about this topic for so long. I guess there's a lot of mistrust. And so that was hard. And then, of course, after about a year and a half, the Pentagon began to change its position. Elements within the Pentagon, after Secretary Mattis, Jim Mattis, who I would consider, an incredible human being, a friend, in fact. Once he left, they started changing their position because they could get away with it. And those individuals who had held a grudge against me now had an ability to really try to make my life miserable, and unfortunately misuse the government apparatus, for example, the public affairs and officers and communication channels like that, to try to discredit me. And that was very, very tough, because that really affected my family very much. And I couldn't just come out swinging. There's a right way and a wrong way to do things. So I had to bite my tongue, and I had to initiate certain efforts. Now people know the IG investigation being one of them, several in fact, and try to allow the system to work. And while engaging, elements within Congress and the legislative branch, elements within the executive branch who knew who I was, they were there when I was giving briefings, senior, very senior people. I had to be very careful and very clever how I pursued this, because they wanted the cat back in the bag. And so fortunately, I had the help of people like Chris Mellon giving me advice, other individuals who I won't name right now, but will probably come out in public at some point, how to maneuver this. And, it's been a long fight. It's been a long, and unfortunately, it's not over. There's still a lot more work needs to be done. I didn't do this to salvage or save my own personal credibility. I did it to salvage the conversation about transparency. And in order to do that, we had to get the facts correct. We had to get the Pentagon to come correct on their positions. And unfortunately, we had to expose a lot of the contradictions that were being made by that bureaucracy. And by the way, let me be clear. I don't want to hold the entire Pentagon or the entire Department of Defense responsible for that. It was only a few individuals, very, very powerful, very well-placed individuals that really were trying to obfuscate this message. And those individuals have subsequently been called out. Again, there's a few more, I think, speed bumps that are going to have to be addressed and potentially removed. But we've come a long way. And, as far as my own personal experience, I wouldn't have wished this on anybody. It's been extremely difficult on my family. Tough for me, because I had to see the pain that they went through, because they know who I am and what I stand for. And to see the constant attacks, and to see that the Pentagon was favoring certain media outlets to, push their agenda and their information. And it was obvious. The problem, it wasn't obvious to the public. For some folks, it was, I think, and you're starting to see now articles coming out by individuals who have a really good understanding of what was going on. But those voices were the minority for a long time. And there you have it. It's been a really tough journey for me personally and for my family.
Just for context, I've tried to split this interview up to past, present, and future. So if there's anything people may be listening to thinking, follow up on that, it may come later down the line, depending on how it goes. I want to ask you, Lou, now, I want to try and make this fair. I get called out for being a fan of yours and whatever that might may entail. And I've said, yeah, I put my eggs in the Lou Elizondo basket at the moment, you know, and I was a fan of TTSA and what they set out to accomplish and what was accomplished. But I think it's fair to say that you are human and you've always said that. And along the lines, you will have made mistakes. What is Absolutely. The biggest mistake you've made or misstep you've taken since leaving ATIP? And what did you learn from it?
Wow. You know, Andy, I think the biggest mistake I've made is one that I haven't been able to recognize yet, because if I don't recognize a mistake, then I can't fix it and I can't address it. And I'm sure I've made a lot. You know, I've made a lot of mistakes, and I try to hold myself accountable and very quickly address it. If I say something that's contradictory, or I say something that later on turns out to be inaccurate because it's either my opinion or the way I read the information. I always try to hold myself accountable. My biggest fear, or my greatest mistake, are those mistakes that I've made. And I haven't recognized, they haven't been brought to my attention yet. So I'm unaware of them, right? And I'm very careful, because a lot of people hold on to every word that I say. And I've been very clear. I leave breadcrumbs, in some cases, you know, loaves of bread along the way for people to follow. But if I've made a mistake and it hasn't been brought to my attention, or I'm unaware of it, then that's truly the biggest mistake, because it can't be fixed, right? It can't be fixed until it's made brought to my attention. I'm made aware of it. So I guess it's the mistakes that I don't realize I've made yet.
In your last Jimmy Church interview, now we started arranging this during your media run announcement back in February. You said at that time you'd just come back from one of the most successful ever visits from DC. What makes a successful visit in this, you know, in this topic in DC?
Yes.
And I want to know as well, I'm a fan of the West Wing TV show. And I remember at one moment of an episode where they said at the start the previous administration had almost cured cancer, and they used that as a let's go cure cancer, let's go and do that big thing. Did you have any nearly moments in DC where we almost got a level of progress that we don't have yet, and for whatever reason it didn't happen?
Yeah. Wow, what an insightful question. Every trip to DC is successful. You know, it depends who we're engaging. There's always new information to be discussed, and new developments and new incidents, new data. But then there's also the conversation of where do we go from here, right? And when people are having a healthy debate on what are the next steps, that's fantastic, because that means people are thinking about the right things. As far as a almost moment, yeah, there's one in particular, but unfortunately I'm not at liberty to discuss it yet. It occurred some time ago. Some colleagues were involved in it. There was a discussion by some very senior people in a former administration to potentially discuss disclosure. And for whatever reasons, it was decided later on not, you know, maybe it wasn't time. I wasn't privy to that. I don't know all the details, and I certainly, you know, it's preliminary right now for me to even comment on it. But there have been those moments where we've come very close to something. And, you know, for whatever reason, it was decided that maybe the timing wasn't right. But again, I want to be very careful, because I'm hearing this third hand. So I don't want to say too much, because, you know, I wasn't there.
And can you talk about any realizations during or after moments during your time in ATIP? It's no secret with your clearance, you would have been privy to some of those videos or pieces of footage or the data some of us would love to see. And we hear talked about, you must have sat back and just went, wow, and just had to take a moment, whether it was in an office or in a car, or can you talk about any of those?
Yeah, I mean, I always reference a 23-minute video. That's a very compelling video. That at some point, if it comes out, people are going to go, holy smokes. But that's not just the only one. People, I've said this before, and let me, if I can maybe reemphasize it. This is happening every week, guys. This is not, I mean, if you're focusing on the Nimitz, not you, but people are focusing just on the Nimitz or the Roosevelt, you're focusing on the wrong things, because this is happening every week. Data's coming in from all over the world, from U.S. collection assets. And again, I want to be careful to say what I say here, but this is happening every week. And more people are coming out and reporting these incidents and capturing video and telemetry data and whatnot. So, it's hard to say, was there a moment? Because every moment, every time you think you've seen, the ultimate video, then more data and more information comes out. And there's another one, right? And then there's another one. And there's another one. And there's a pilot coming and saying, look, I chased this thing for half an hour. I couldn't get close to it. So there's not just one compelling video. There's a lot of data out there that's continuing to come to fruition regarding the efforts and the policies that have recently been put in place for that information to be reported. There was a hope that increased reporting would occur, and again, like I said, that's coming to fruition. It's happening.
Over time, you mentioned pilots chasing these objects for up to half an hour or longer, and back in the Tic Tac event, that's been talked about ad nauseum. That they were there hovering for hours and 12 hours at a time, which we just don't have that technology. Has there been any data presented to yourself you can talk about that we've noticed that the technology of these UAP have improved over time? You've mentioned that going back to the 50s and 60s, we've seen these objects, but is there any notable difference now?
No. It seems to be the same technology being displayed. I mean, we have radar tracks and radar data, these things doing upwards of 13,000 miles an hour in low Earth atmosphere, where the friction coefficient of that is astounding. It's almost like it'd be like swimming through dirt. It's just the air is so thick, and when you're moving that fast, air density and air friction is problematic. That's the reason why, case in point, the SR-71, Lockheed YF-12A SR-71, the Blackbird, it is an aircraft comprised entirely of titanium, because it gets superheated, even though it's flying at many tens of thousands of feet in altitude and traveling at 3,200 miles an hour, forgive me. The friction is so high that on some of the colder parts of the engine, it's still like 800, 900 degrees. So, and that's at 3,200 miles an hour. Imagine, speeds several times faster. It's almost unimaginable, almost incomprehensible. And the SR-71 is very, very high when it's flying like that with that amount of heat. The lower you go in atmosphere, it just that friction coefficient just goes up and up and up. And we have historical data going back to the 50s, where these things, 60s, where these things were tracked doing 8,000, 9,000, 10,000 miles an hour. So I don't think we have seen a steady increase in their capabilities. The capabilities seem to be the same. What we do see is an increased prevalence of these things being seen. And we don't know if that's a function of simply technology. Everybody now has a cell phone. The world is more densely populated. It could be that there really is an increased prevalence. We don't know yet. There's data to suggest both may be true.
And on that data, the line is now famous. There's a whole fleet of them. Look on the SA. Can you tell us how often there were multiple UAPs reported compared to an individual craft? Was there a pattern recognized or any takeaway from that?
Well, they were flying in a V formation. That we do know. And more of these things were tracked and actually seen with the naked eye. It's interesting because some of the historical videos that have described a triangular vehicle, the problem is when you're looking at a blank sky and you see three points of light, there's no reference, there's no depth. And the question is, is there an object in the middle? Is there a solid object in the middle? Or is it really three separate, vehicles, so to speak, or points of light? And, orientation also means a lot. And so it's difficult. We have seen cases where we thought we saw some material, a triangular craft, and it turned out later that it was actually three separate UAP. And in other cases, it turns out where we think we see three separate UAP, and it's actually part of a single vehicle. And so, you know, I think it's probably too early to tell right now. Is there a greater frequency of vehicles flying in formation, and do they accompany other UAP? Certainly, that has happened. There's a lot of data that suggests sometimes they fly together. They even can. It looks like some of these things are actually kicked off, almost like think of a drone or a UAV coming from a mothership, if you will. I hate to use that term, but you know, from a larger vehicle, a larger craft. I think it's, you know, I don't know if there's been any real analysis to make a determination that most UAP incidents involve a fleet of them, right? As we heard, as you're talking about the famous video, look on the ASA, right? I don't know. I do know that there's data on both singular craft and multiple vehicles being seen and interacting with each other to some degree. You know, it goes back. It's interesting. There's some old historical reporting from right before the beginning of the Renaissance, during the Middle Ages, in 1600s actually. So in Nuremberg, famous Nuremberg incident in Germany, where a lot of different shaped vehicles, lenticular craft and cylindrical craft and triangular craft, little orbs of light, seemed to be interacting with each other. And some even described it that there was some sort of aerial dogfight between vehicles. Obviously, this is centuries before my time, so I certainly can't speak in an articulate manner regarding that incident. But you know, there were a lot of eyewitnesses that discussed that. Of these vehicles flying in formation, if you will.
Did you know that podcast advertising is way more effective than display advertising? With 67% of listeners remembering brands and 63% making a purchase after hearing them. Whether you want to diversify your ad spend, add a new marketing stream, or test out podcast ads, Zencastr's creator network makes it easy for brands to connect with podcasters. Zencastr's mission is to make podcast advertisements as easy and accessible to business owners as Google or Facebook. Host-read ads like this are the most effective form of podcast advertising. Zencastr works with podcasters to help create unique to them ad spots that create brand awareness and conversion. Zencastr's creator network is the perfect place for you to get into podcast ads and sponsor your favorite creators like me. I've worked with Zencastr now for some time, and they truly put the content creators and the listeners at the heart of what they do. As a huge fan of podcasts myself, and I really mean that, I love podcasts, I often buy products or services that I find useful to me based on those pods that I'm listening to. It supports them, and there's usually a good discount to go along with it. So if you're interested in sponsoring this show or another podcast with adverts for your business, go to zen.ai/thatufopod1. That's the number one, or click the link in the description and fill out the contact information so Zencastr can help you bring your business story to life. You mentioned an increase in sightings. You know, is that down to us having more cell phones or Navy technologies, military technology improving month on month, maybe week on week? Are they noticing us noticing them more?
Well, they certainly are aware that we are now aware. Dave Fravor actually talks about, as he goes to engage and cut the gap and try to engage this tic tac, it orientated itself at him, pointed at him, and kept a safe distance from his aircraft and kind of mirrored his maneuvers in order to keep a safe distance. And then, you know, bang, as he starts to close the gap, it then demonstrates that it's not very happy with Dave Fravor, and so it disappears over the horizon. There does seem to be some sort of awareness there. It's not like, we're walking in the desert and there's, you know, we don't notice the ants on the floor. It definitely seems that they are very well aware of our presence and respond accordingly. People talk about communication, but, you know, when I take a treat and I tell my dog to sit and the dog sits, you know, I'm training the dog, but at the same time, the dog has trained me. When the dog, you know, whines and wants to go outside, the dog has trained me to go open the door because he needs to go to the bathroom, right? So it's communication doesn't have to be verbal. And you know, one can surmise that, you know, by us doing certain things and it responds accordingly, that's a form of communication. And, you know, it we do see that there's an interest, a keen interest in our nuclear equities. So anyways, there you have it. I think it's I think there's definitely an awareness of our presence. That's pretty clear.
Dave Fravor's incident has been well documented, and Commander Fravor talked about it on several shows. Have you spoken to other pilots who have had incidents as spectacular as that close?
Absolutely.
And have they described very similar behaviors or anything different?
Yeah, absolutely. Both similar and different. It's, you know, it's really an enigma. There's pilots who have tried to engage it. There's a pilot I spoke to in South America who they had like 1,000 eyewitnesses. They were doing a formation on the air on the tarmac, and there was this UAP over the airbase. So they scrambled one of the most premier fighter aircraft, Russian fighter aircraft, to engage this thing. And you know, he fired his cannons at it, and you know, it didn't do a damn thing. You know, there's other ones where these things will come in, you know, right next to the aircraft, right off the wingtip, and just kind of almost like it's unbelievable. Almost like fly as a wingman for a while. Almost like play with the pilot. You know, almost I hate to say playful way, because we really don't know, but there doesn't seem to be any obvious signs of aggression. Almost kind of like, hey, you know, let's go play and let me show you what I can do, right? So that's been reported as well.
It sounds like dolphins when they swim alongside boats, and they'll do flips and maneuvers, and then just go off and do their own thing.
Yeah, they ride the bow wave, right? And you know, they'll kind of demonstrate, look how maneuverable I am in the water, right? And I can flip and turn and spin, and you know, here you are just plowing through the waves. That's a good analogy.
You mentioned, interestingly, going back to the past, different shapes of craft, lenticular and such, and excuse the slightly longer question here. Part of the recently declassified but heavily redacted UAP Task Force report contained a page on the shape of UAP. Tic Tacs seem to have replaced the classic saucer shape in terms of the go-to descriptor that you see online from people these days. However, to your knowledge, are the US military and others still encountering a range of shaped craft that are categorically not adversarial technologies?
You're asking me two different questions, actually. You're asking me, are they still encountering different shapes craft? Yes, absolutely. It's not just Tic Tacs. But the second part of your question is, you know, are they certainly not adversarial technology? What I can say is we think that they're not adversarial technology. You don't know what you don't know. It's highly unlikely that some of these are foreign technology, but as we continue to evolve technologically speaking, we're getting more and more advanced in our capabilities. And so at some point, we may find ourselves in a situation where some of these UAP could absolutely be replicated by a foreign government. I don't think we're there yet, and I think that the general consensus by the intelligence communities that we're not there yet, but at some point, the more we understand and learn about these things, the more we may have the ability to replicate some of their performance.
And your answer, would that be the reason, or one of the reasons, that page is so heavily redacted, is because if the US government show that we know there's this shape, and this shape, and it turns out those are actually Chinese drones, you don't want the Chinese to know that you know they have that object?
Precisely. You know, you don't ever want to broadcast your vulnerabilities, and you also don't want to broadcast what you know about your enemy. You know, that's very important. It's part of counterintelligence. You don't want to reveal. It's like playing a game of chess. You don't want to tell your enemy what your next move is, and you don't want to tell your enemy what your own pieces are capable of. That's you know, not a very smart way to play chess. So you're absolutely correct. That's certainly one reason to keep things classified.
Any other reasons, if that's one of them, that you could go into?
Yeah, I mean, we could spend here all day talking about why we classify information.
You know, particularly, I suppose, the shape. Sorry, I should have gave you context there. The actual shape of the objects, why would that be classified?
You know, there's something called blue force and red force capabilities. Blue force are considered your own technologies. Red Force are considered the technologies of your adversaries. We spend billions of dollars each year in research and development trying to keep a competitive advantage over our adversaries. We do have some very sophisticated technologies that I'm certainly not going to go into. And you want to protect those equities. Is it possible in the past that some people have confused UFOs with advanced secret U.S. technology? Well, sure, we know that. That happened with the B-2 bomber program. People would report the black flying wing, and also the old wobbly goblin, the the 117, the night fighter. People often look. We even see it right now in the commercial world, right? With Elon Musk and Starlink, people see these chains of satellites. I see them all the time out here in Wyoming. That this chain of satellites, 50, 60 long in a string, almost like a string of pearls, and people report that as being UFOs. Because if you've never seen it before, then certainly it's going to be something that's going to be novel and it's going to pique your interest. And it may seem like an unidentified flying object when in reality it's just a new type of technology. The government wants to protect a lot of those key technologies, not Starlink necessarily, but other technologies that we employ and develop because we spend a lot of money on it, right? And we don't want an adversary coming in and stealing it. And then, having that same advantage on the battle space. So there's all sorts of reasons. We could spend here probably the next 3 hours if you really wanted to and talk about it. But, there's good reason why even the shapes of vehicles may wind up being redacted. Because a shape can tell you a lot. Let's look at this little aircraft here for a moment, right? If I were to show you this, and compare this to, let's say, the model of a biplane, right? Well, just by looking at the shape of this probably tells you a whole lot, right? You have a delta wing configuration, small control surfaces, so you can assume this is probably going to fly very, very fast. When you look at the intakes are on top of the aircraft, on top of the airframe, not below. So that probably tells you that this is a vehicle that is designed to have a low signature. You can tell a lot by a simple shape, this is just a little toy, right? So yeah, there's reasons why you want to keep certain things classified and shapes can tell you a lot. They can tell you physical characteristics and even performance capabilities and potentially even, something manned or unmanned. So there you have it.
And last year, Lou, on some interviews, you mentioned China was potentially going to attempt to raise the UAP issue within the UN. Is that something that is still progressing that you can speak about?
Well, they did. They did. It was called the Five Continents Initiative, and they were behind that. And it did not go, I think, as planned. I think people became very wise very quickly as you don't want one nation controlling the narrative. And that includes the United States. This is something that impacts everyone. I think everybody should have an equal say in this topic from a governmental perspective. And this is why we've tried to what I've said before, democratize the conversation. The problem for the last 70 years is that we haven't democratized the conversation. It's been held in small enclaves of organizations and institutions and governments. And that hasn't been very helpful towards transparency. So we are trying to democratize the conversation. And I think the United Nations is certainly someplace that would be very good to have this conversation on an international level. Furthermore, there's efforts we see with Italy right now and the small Republic of San Marino, by the way, the longest standing republic in the entire world since the 1300s. I had the honor and privilege of going there and speaking to some members of the government of San Marino. And maybe having a small enclave like that would be great to have an annual UN meeting on this topic. There was an initiative called the Titan. Titan is the name of the mountain there in San Marino, Titan was chosen as a name to perhaps try and get the rest of the world on board with having a summit, if you will, an international summit on the UAP topic, hosted there by San Marino. San Marino is a neutral country. They have it even during the World War II. you know, it's a bit of a Switzerland. And, you know, there seems to be some interest. And I, for one, think it's a great idea. You know, so I think international involvement is critical. I don't think that China should be leading the effort, just like I don't think U.S. should be leading the effort. You know, I'm not trying to offend anybody who, you know, is from China. What I'm simply saying is that no one country should own the narrative or control the narrative.
Lou, I'm going to move on to discuss the present. So we've covered the past there quite well, I think, and appreciate the answers. Of course, I'm going to discuss Gary Reid. However, I would point people to Ryan Robbins. If you search UFO Jesus on YouTube, done a 37-minute interview which dropped on the 22nd of April, which covers that situation in quite a lot of detail and covers it quite well, Lou. And I'll put the links for that in the description. However, I do want to know, you stated on that interview that Gary Reid made progress on the UAP topic difficult. Is the road now clearer for others who are on the side of progress within the government to come forward? Or is this a Hydra-type situation where you cut off one head and two more will take its place?
No, I think it certainly made it easier. The problem is that in the government, there's still elements that don't appreciate the topic. They consider this issue of UAP as an issue of air clutter and space trash, space junk. And, you know, with the hopes of, well, if we can identify more air clutter and space junk, then we can, you know, put this to bed and UFOs are not real. That's not the case. UFOs represent breakaway technology. UFOs, UAP, it represents breakaway technology. It's not a matter of air trash. Yes, we have air trash out there, and we have clutter. And there's laws that require U.S. air domain awareness, but those laws have been around forever. I mean, they've been around for a long, long time, especially after 9/11. There was really an increased emphasis on trying to figure out what's in our airspace. But don't make the mistake of lumping UAP, which represents something completely different, as an air clutter issue or an air trash issue. That's a mistake. And so, you know, trying to have that discussion with bureaucrats who just don't get it, right? And they want this monkey off their back, and they want to answer Congress and scratch that itch so they can move on to do other things. That's not going to happen. And I don't know how to tell people politely who are still in these positions of power and influence, but that's a mistake. And you're not meeting the intent of Congress if you think that you're going to wrap this up as air clutter issue or space junk. Then you probably need to start looking for another job at some point, because that's not the intent of Congress, and it's not the intent of the American people, certainly. And so That's one of the concerns I have right now, and making sure that people remain informed and educated about this topic. You know, it's complex, and people want to know, and, you know, the UFO hobbyist out there, you know, doesn't really necessarily appreciate all the nuances, what's going on right now. I mean, this is, we're still in a fight. We're still in a battle. We won a significant battle, but the war is not over regarding transparency in this topic. It's hard fought. Every single day we are engaged in trying to get this topic elevated where it needs to be elevated, and having the intent of Congress met, because ultimately the intent of Congress is the intent of the American people. They work for their constituents. Their constituents have spoken. We want this addressed. So anybody who is in the executive branch who thinks that, you know, addressing this as just, you know, air clutter and air trash, you're not meeting the will and the intent of the American people ultimately. And that's a problem, because your job is to serve the American people. You know? And so that's why I say, look, you know, I'm trying to be polite, but you don't want to make that mistake. You know, please look at what's just happened. You know, if you're not serving the intent of the American people, then chances are you're not going to last very long in the government, because people are now wise to this topic. And they're not going to let you get away with just obfuscation. That's not going to occur. Certainly not while people like me and Chris Mellon are alive. We have no problem. There's a vernacular calling, I guess, in cards, calling the spade a spade, right? In cards. We have no problem doing that. I have no problem addressing malfeasance. I have no problem addressing ineptitude and corruptness. I'm not at all opposed to calling people out on that on national TV and the media, because ultimately we have to hold these people accountable. Their job is to in essence, represent the will of the people and to execute the will of the people. And if they don't do that, you know, again, probably better off finding another job.
Many of those people you talk about who have an interest in this subject are eagerly awaiting the next video to hopefully be declassified or leaked or dropped. Someone to show us the famous photographs that, you know, the black triangles, whatever they may be, whether they really exist or not. Something that is coming is your book. And is that finished yet?
I am working very diligently on it. I'm definitely progressing quite well with it. I want to be very careful, you know, always manage expectations. I'd rather under promise and over deliver if I have my choice. But I know that it is coming along quite well. I'm working on it very diligently, and I think it's going to be very informative when it comes out.
Is it a book that you want to write, or is it a book that you need to write?
It's a book I need to write. No, it's a lot of work. I don't want to write the book. It needs to be written because people need to know the truth. Because once you write that book and it's in writing, it can never be taken away. And that is, you know, think of a slide rule, right? You know, I want to make a point using this book where we can never go backwards in time. You'll never be able, you might slow progress if you are, you know, in charge of this effort, but you'll never be able to put the genie back in the bottle, because the book will be definitive and it's going to say, this is what happened and this is what's happening and these are the facts. And then at that point, you know, people can use that as hopefully a new starting point for this conversation.
What's been the hardest part of writing the book?
Wow. You know, you can only put so much in a book. you can only put, you know, 300 so pages. I mean, I could put 1,000 pages, 2,000 pages in this. So it's the hardest part is probably figuring out what you have to leave out, what you have to cut out, just because there's so much information that's available. This is still the book's writing itself right now. I mean, it's still evolving, right? Because every day there's new information and new things that are happening. That you know, have to be in the book. And I guess, you know, the biggest concern is I have the book and all of a sudden it comes out. But, you know, during that time it's being published, there's more information that really should be in the book. So, you know, it's kind of a, you know, it's a bit of a frustration, because it's this topic is evolving so quickly now that it's almost impossible to make the determination, okay, what, you know, do I put this in and leave this out, or do I put that in and leave this out? Right. And I think it's going to be, I think it's going to be very helpful for the discussion.
The things that you do leave out are what people like me will ask you when you come to talk about the book on shows in the future. One of those shows that people ask about is Joe Rogan. Now, Chris Mellon has been on Joe Rogan. Dave Fravor has been on Joe Rogan. George Knapp. You, as of yet, are still conspicuous by your absence. Has that been something that has been planned and never happened, or is it something that's in the future for you? Hi everyone, Andy here. This is a special announcement for folks who listen to the show via Spotify. You can now support the pod directly through Spotify for less than the price of a coffee each month, giving you ad-free content, no sponsorships, early access and bonus shows as well. So many of you have chosen to support the show through Patreon and Apple Premium, and I appreciate this has been a long time coming for Spotify listeners. Just search That UFO Podcast Premium in Spotify, or click the link in this description for this announcement. Otherwise, Apple Premium is still available with a 2-week free trial as well, again from less than the price of a coffee, or you can sign up for Patreon for the additional benefits that come with those tiers. Again, thank you to everyone who supports the podcast and just listens to the shows. Lots of great content to come. That is all for this week's show. Thank you very much for listening. Please remember to leave the podcast a review on your chosen platform. You can like, retweet and subscribe. That would all be very much appreciated. The shows are being uploaded onto YouTube as we speak more and more. You can sign up at patreon.com/thatufopodcast to access the shows ad-free as well. Please get in touch on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, That UFO Podcast. Of course, on Twitter, it's @UFOUAPAM. And again, folks, as always, keep looking up. You never know what you might see.
It wasn't a Tic Tac and not quite a saucer. More like a hubcap designed by Chaucer. A little baroque and quite steampunk, like Alice was playing bass for the Parliament of Funk. The little fucker hovered right outside of my window, and when I shoved out the screen, he made it an issue. I don't think he expected me to see his ass, but I'd had some champagne and smoked a little grass. Meditated again and stayed full on meta. Can't imagine how it could have been any better. I got to the top of the stairs and there he was. Like, you awake? I was about to abduct you, cuz. Back and nearly kissed myself, and I climbed out the window after the elf, and I woke up in my bed, and there was something on my head, and everything was weird, and everything was red. I called up my boys, they thought this was noise, they thought it was a dream, they thought it was my toys, they thought it was my problems, and they think I should take care of me, and I don't know what to do, because it doesn't really scare me.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org. One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Every business has an ambition. PayPal Open is the platform designed to help you grow into yours. With business loans so you can expand and access to hundreds of millions of PayPal customers worldwide. And your customers can pay all the ways they want. With PayPal, Venmo, Pay Later, and all major cards. So you can focus on scaling up. When it's time to get growing, there's one platform for all business. PayPal Open. Grow today at paypalopen.com. Loan subject to approval in available locations.